first case on calendar today is case number 59630, Fiesta Palms LLC versus Rodriguez. Are counsel ready to proceed?
Ready, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
Before we do, I wanted to make an announcement that Justice Hardesty is participating on this panel, but he's doing so remotely by listening to the webcast. He had an unavoidable conflict that prevented him from being here in person today, and he sends his regrets to both counsel that he could not be.
That he will not be able to ask questions?
He will not. So if you're prepared to proceed, Mr. Eisenberg, please do so. And let the clerk know what time you want to reserve for rebuttal.
I'd like to request 5 minutes for rebuttal, please. May it please the Court, Robert Eisenberg on behalf of the appellant. If this Court affirms the judgment in this case, it could have a drastic impact on sports and entertainment in Nevada. Anybody who's ever been to a Wolfpack or a Rebels basketball game or football game knows that cheerleaders toss souvenir T-shirts and other items to the crowd. They do the same thing at entertainment events, the Blue Man Group, Cirque du Soleil. The same thing happens at parades, the Nevada Day Parade, Hot August Night Parade. Things are thrown to the audience. People expect it, and spectators want it. It's part of the experience of the sporting event and the entertainment event. And we respectfully contend that if this Court affirms this $6 million judgment against the Palms, that could all drastically change. The plaintiff here went to an event that he saw advertised as Monday Night Football Frenzy with Brandy Beavers. When he got there to watch the Monday Night Football game, he stood by the door, and for an hour he watched the activities. At least six times he saw the girls dressed as cheerleaders throwing souvenir items to the crowd. He didn't have the slightest inkling that there was any danger. He testified that if he thought that there was any danger, he was standing by the door, all he had to do was step out the door. He wouldn't have stayed. But there was no danger perceivable to him or anybody else by throwing these or tossing these harmless souvenirs, an empty water bottle with the Palms logo on it. But something completely unexpected happened as a result of another patron's activities. When a water bottle landed near him, another patron unexpectedly leaped up and did a total body dive. That's what the plaintiff described it. A total body dive to get the water bottle, and she banged into his knee. And as a result of that, he sued and ended up with a $6 million judgment from Judge Walsh. Testified that it was very unusual, and in fact, what the other patron did, the question was, and it was a complete surprise to you? Absolutely. And as best as you can tell, a complete surprise to everybody else who was there? Correct. Now, in the Turner case, this court held that the owner of a baseball stadium was not liable as a matter of law when a spectator got hit in the face by a baseball. In the Estelle Smith case, this court held that, as a matter of law, the casino was not liable when one patron pulled out a gun at a casino bar and shot and killed another patron. And if getting hit in the face by a baseball in a baseball game imposes no liability as a matter of law to the owner of the business, and getting shot and killed at a bar provides no liability as a matter of law to the casino owner. How can the Palms be liable when they are doing what everybody does at sporting events, and that is tossing souvenirs to the audience?
Now, doesn't the rule in Turner apply strictly to stadium owners and operators? You're clearly asking us to extend that rule to another context here.
Well, in the Turner case, yes, it did involve a baseball stadium owner, and the patron got hit by a baseball.
And the inherent danger that a fly ball could come hit you in the in the head if you're in the stands, a hockey puck if you're at a hockey game, and so on. But it didn't reach lobbing items into the crowd.
No, it didn't. And to that extent, yes, we're simply asking the court to apply Turner and to apply the Estate of Smith case in this case.
And the Estate of Smith had to do with the criminal act of a third party, correct?
Right, and what the court said was that even though there was a history of other criminal acts in and around the casino, that it wasn't enough to make it so foreseeable that liability could be imposed. And the court said, as a matter of law, there was no liability in that case. This case is simply a logical extension of Turner, and court after court have applied it to tossing souvenirs or other things at baseball games when after the third out, the player's running off the field, he tosses a ball up to the stands. And like I said, at Rebels games, Wolfpack games, people, the cheerleaders routinely throw T-shirts and other items. So this is nothing more than an extension of that. Now, the plaintiff says, well, it's not part of the game. It's not part of the game itself, like a foul ball would be in baseball. But court after court that we've cited have talked about the experience that people have when they go to a sporting event. And it's part of the sporting event. And the courts have recognized that the spectators want that kind of activity. They want the excitement. They're hoping that one of those souvenirs comes their way so they can catch it. And if it's a T-shirt, they open it up and show it to everybody. That's what they want. And so the fact that that throwing a souvenir is not part of the game really is irrelevant. The plaintiff also says, well, this didn't happen at a live sporting event. This happened at a sports book, at a casino. And we see no logical difference between the two. If a cheerleader tosses a souvenir T-shirt to the crowd at a live basketball game and does the same thing at a televised basketball game as a sports book, there's no difference, at least we don't believe logically, between the two. At least not a difference that makes a significant difference from a legal standpoint. So we don't believe there's a duty.
Could you address also the expert issues with respect to Dr. Schiaffini and the exclusion of Cargill and the other expert on the grounds they didn't state their opinions to reasonable degrees of professional certainty?
Absolutely, and those are two separate issues, and I'll deal with the doctor's issue first. This is the worst imaginable case of litigation sandbagging. The plaintiff identifies 28 or 30 doctors, identifies them as treating physicians, and he gives a generic description. They're only going to testify about the treatment that they rendered to the plaintiff. He does identify one retained expert doctor, but he decides later on not to call that doctor as a witness at trial. So they get to trial, and the defense counsel has made his decisions on who's going to depose or not depose based on the fact that these are treating physicians. Then they get to trial, and plaintiff's counsel calls four doctors to testify about all of the other doctors' medical care, and to testify far beyond the scope of their own personal treatment of the plaintiff. Dr. Schiaffini is the worst example of that. Dr. Schiaffini, when during discovery, he provided 21 pages of his medical records. He shows up at trial and he says, well, I've reviewed thousands of medical records pages provided to him by plaintiff's counsel, and then he proceeds to render opinions on those, opinions about whether the care rendered by the other doctors was reasonable and necessarily incurred, whether the medical expenses generated by the other doctors were reasonable and necessarily incurred, all far beyond the scope of his treatment. But the worst thing was the life care plan. The plaintiff designates a life care plan expert who has a certain amount. Defense counsel deposes her. Then they get to trial, and plaintiff's counsel decides not to call her as a witness. Instead, he has Dr. Schiaffini testify that the life care plan generated by the plaintiff's own expert was wrong. He said it's the worst he's ever seen. And he proceeds to add $1 million to it. And defense counsel never had the slightest hint before that that was going to happen, never disclosed.
So there was no expert report at all for Dr. Shafini? He was designated purely as a treater?
He was designated as a treater in 21 pages.
What ostensibly did he treat this plaintiff for?
He saw the plaintiff about 3 years after the accident. He's an anesthesiologist, but he specializes in pain management.
Okay.
And treated him for that.
What's the status of the, and I don't know how to pronounce it, Giorzi case out of the, Giorzi where they, it's a federal district court of Nevada case addressing Dr. Shafini's testimony and saying he was used improperly as a Trojan horse to smuggle in other opinions in essence?
Exactly, and that was the same.
Has that been appealed or reversed?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
And I shepherdize everything before we cited, and that's so far.
Or key-cited, perhaps.
Pardon me?
Or key-cited.
Yeah, I guess shepherdize is old school. But yes, that's a perfect example involving Dr. Shafini, the same one here. And even though that was a published decision by a magistrate federal judge, it shows the same concept. And we're not saying, contrary to what plaintiff's counsel is saying, we are not saying that they have to bring every treating physician into trial and call them all as witnesses. All we're saying is that if the plaintiff's counsel takes a treating physician, provides that doctor with additional records, and morphs that physician into a retained expert, all we're saying is give the defense fair notice of that so the defense can decide whether or not to depose that doctor on those new opinions. Just give him fair notice. Now, the other, with my time running out here, the other issue you mentioned is the exclusion of the two experts. There was the Mr. Franklin, who was an expert in crowd control and security, and then the economist, Dr. Cargo. Now, they both testify. There's stipulation that they're both qualified to testify as experts in their field. They testify. They give their opinions. There's no objection to their opinions. And then after they leave, and at the end of trial, then plaintiff's counsel, this is another example of litigation sandbagging. After these witnesses are gone, then plaintiff's counsel moves to strike their testimony on the ground that they didn't use magic words, and that was counsel's own phrase, magic words. And he said they have to use magic words. Why? Because they're magic. Because they suddenly transform inadmissible expert testimony into admissible expert testimony. Judge Walsh bought into that. And she said because they didn't use those magic words, a reasonable degree of professional certainty, she struck their testimony. And although those words may be magic and may be required in some medical contexts involving perhaps diagnosis or causation, this court has made it clear that those magic words are not always required for all experts. And in fact, I think it's the Brown case says that where there was medical testimony regarding the standard of care in the medical community, and the doctor didn't say the magic words, reasonable degree of medical probability, and this court said that that was not required because that testimony did not involve probabilities. That's the same thing here. Mr. Franklin testified that this conduct in this case was not negligent because it did not violate the standard of care in the community. Yet the judge struck it because he didn't say the magic words. I see I have about 2 minutes left, Your Honor, so I'd like to reserve the rest of the time. Thank you.
Mr. Wall.
Thank you, Your Honor. I thank Your Honors for allowing us to be here to argue today. I represent Enrique Rodriguez, who was seriously injured in an accident that was caused by the negligence of the Palms. Of the Fiesta Palms. The idea that this was sudden and nobody expected it based on the testimony that was given is simply one of the many, many red herrings in this case. It is not really a matter whether Enrique thought this woman was going to jump into his knee or not. The question isn't whether this particular body dive was a surprise to Enrique or a surprise to anybody else, for that matter. The question is whether or not this behavior was foreseeable and whether or not this injury was the type of injury that was foreseeable. And it was. And that brings us to the argument, the main argument that we have, and that is, if I go to a baseball game, I might get hit by a baseball. And this isn't a baseball game. It's not a sporting event. It's an event at a casino. It's where they bring people in to gamble and to drink, and they're having a party. There was no testimony from their expert that had anything to do with this kind of a setting. There was no testimony whatsoever from the defense that as to this standard of care. Instead, they basically had an expert who said, yeah, I think throwing things into the stand is okay. My counsel stood up here and said, there are all these cases in the baseball things. I don't believe any of them have to do with throwing things into the audience, but even if they did, it's a different situation at a convention. It's a different type of crowd at a baseball game, and this is not a hockey game. This is where the Palms invited people in, put them into a crowded area, had their own people testify that they thought it was a dangerous thing to do, to throw things into the stand, set up a goalpost, put up the cheerleaders, spun them around in circles, and threw things in every direction. It had to be expected that people were going to go diving for this thing. This isn't a bottle that was laying on the ground. The testimony is that it was thrown, a man tried to catch it and missed it, and both he and this woman went for it. The man got it. That's the testimony. In doing so, he injured my client, and he injured him seriously. It's not a baseball game. Turner should not be extended to reach a baseball game. Now, they talked about the standard of care, and they've insinuated that we have applied the wrong standard of care, that the district court implied the wrong standard of care, but there's no evidence of that. The standard of care is that negligence is the failure to use reasonable care. The Palms failed to use reasonable care. In this type of situation, from the state of Smith, a landowner is liable for foreseeable injuries occurring on the premises. Now, Smith was third-party liability. I pointed that out in my briefing. Counsel said, well, this is a third party, the woman who dove into the knee. We didn't sue the woman who dove into the knee for her, nor did we sue the Palms because through the negligence of the woman who dove into the knee. We sued the Palms because they created a peril. And even if that danger that they created is obvious, the landowner is still negligent if they create a peril, an unreasonable peril, and there's foreseeable risk. And the foreseeable risk here is not only foreseeable, it's foreseen. The testimony of the Palms employees, highest level employees, and managers, was that they didn't want things thrown because they foresaw that somebody might be injured. That doesn't go to holding the casino to a higher standard than the normal standard of care, and there's not a word in the district court's order saying that she's holding them to a higher standard of care. That's simply evidence of the standard of care. They created an unreasonable situation where injury, the type of injury that happened, was foreseeable.
That's exactly what happened. The district court judge did base her decision on the concept that testimony gave rise to an internal safety rule that this conduct of Brandon Beavers violated, correct?
No, I don't believe that the record supports that. The record supports that she saw that evidence and it supported the standard of care. It doesn't, she never once said, I'm holding them to a standard, a higher standard, or a standard they set. It simply says she went through and she saw that evidence, and that evidence went to that element of the regular standard of foreseeability. And that's what we put them in for, to testify to foreseeability.
If we affirm your position that I use the term opening the door to concert situations where a guitar player throws out a pick, or at Thomas and Mack, where they don't even use the cheerleaders anymore throwing it, they use a cannon, like a machine gun that shoots the shirts out. Does that mean that there's always enough to get to a jury in these cases, Mr. Wall?
No, that wouldn't mean that there's always enough to get to the jury. You would have to look at each situation. In a baseball game, there wouldn't be enough to get to a jury.
There's always going to be people diving for an object, whether it be a guitar pick or Elvis's scarf or anything that you throw to an audience. whether it be a concert or any type of showroom situation here in Las Vegas, or Thomas and Mack or Ed Lauer at the Reno Stadium.
But here we have, in a very small setting in the casino, the throwing of objects in a frenzied atmosphere. This isn't just people in the audience and having things thrown at them. Certainly there's going to be line drawing that will have to be done as to what situation there is. But to say that the district judge was wrong in this case, to have determined after all of this evidence came in that the proponents created a circumstance that was unreasonably dangerous with foreseeable damages, injury, and not only foreseeable injury, but a foreseen injury, exactly the injury that they foresaw, the liability element of this has been established.
Why isn't it foreseeable then at Thomas and Mack that when they shoot these T-shirts into the audience that somebody could dive and hurt one of the persons just sitting there, or even standing there?
That type of foreseeability may be there, but that's exactly what we've had in all of the cases, is a weighing of how foreseeable is it, and is it foreseeable as a matter of law to the extent that we would not allow it, and it violates the standard of care. When you're sitting in the stadium, somebody might do something like that, but it's not the same risk that you have when you've created. You bring them in and you create a party atmosphere. That's what they have here. It's a difference. It's in a casino, in a small room where they have the game on TV. It's not a sporting event. It's an easy thing to do to say that this is a part of a sporting event, and we will draw the line there. And when it stops being a sporting event and it's some other event, we're going to have to look at all of the circumstances and determine what the standard should be. In this case, they knew they were creating a dangerous situation. They created the dangerous situation, and the injury happened. And that's what happened.
I'd like to move to Dr. Shafin. But just briefly before you do, the findings of fact and conclusions of law state that the defendant has conceded that there was a known safety procedure prohibiting promotional items from being thrown into the crowds, and that they conceded that they violated this known safety procedure as related to the case at bar. Where do you find those concessions? Is that the testimony of the risk manager or the marketing director?
The only evidence to that was the testimony of the risk manager and the marketing director. That's correct.
So you would say, given that safety procedure, if anybody's injured when something is thrown into the crowd, there's liability as a matter of law?
No, I wouldn't say that. I would say under the circumstances here, the injury was foreseeable. And if you look at all of the circumstances,
so you're applying a regular negligence standard.
Regular negligence standard. They created the peril. That testimony went to the foreseeability of the injury, and therefore they created a dangerous situation.
And I do want to hear about Shafini and the experts, but before I do, could you answer whether or not you're contending for a premises liability type of standard or just straight-up negligence?
This is a premises liability standard, but premises liability is the same negligence standard. The owner of the premises is held to the same standard, which is that the landowner is liable for foreseeable injuries occurring on the premises and has to act in a manner which is reasonable care under all of the circumstances. We no longer have an invitee or those types of standards. It's the same standard. Your Honor, the testimony about the doctors, it's very difficult to argue against a negative, and that's what I'm doing here, because what it says happened at this trial in the plaintiff's brief simply did not happen. And that's the problem that I have. If you read the testimony, counsel says that I said I read the testimony and you should rely on me, wink, wink, nod, nod. I did no such thing. They made accusations of the doctors having testified in a particular manner, and they didn't give any examples of that. So after having told the court that there weren't any examples and they've asked you to go looking for them, I said I went looking for them and didn't find them. That's because they're not there. If you read the testimony of all of the doctors carefully, you will find not one doctor testified at any point to the opinion of some other doctor. Generally speaking, when the doctors spoke to the records of other doctors, it was on cross-examination because defense counsel was trying to prove to the doctor who was testifying that some other doctor had a different opinion than that doctor. Not once did one of those doctors imply or give an opinion to another doctor. It simply is not in that record. If you look at it, I tried to set it out carefully in my brief. The doctor said, let me get this exactly right. Dr. Kidwell and Dr. Favitt, that's the one that they focused on. Of course, it all came in cross-examination. Dr. Favitt, who saw the patient early, was not in the, of the impression that there should be surgery. They say, and Dr. Kidwell said there should be surgery, so they kept hitting him with Dr. Favitt's testimony, saying, well, why do you disagree with Dr. Favitt? He says there, should be there shouldn't be surgery. If you look at that testimony, they say that Dr. Kidwell said, well, if Dr. Favitt knew what I know, he would have said there should be surgery. Never does that testimony come out. You cannot find that in the record because it doesn't exist. When pushed, Dr. Kidwell did say, Dr. Favitt, I don't know why. He was asked over and over to explain why Dr. Favitt said no surgery. He said, I don't know why. He didn't have all the evidence at that time. He had different things to deal with. There was still the knee problem to deal with. I don't know why Dr. Favitt said there shouldn't be surgery there, but the question you should be asking me is, why did I think there should be surgery at that time? And that question was not asked by defense counsel.
What about Schifini?
You wanted an answer to.
What about Dr. Schifini? That was of greater concern.
Dr. Schifini is one of the most important treating physicians for Amiki. He's the physician who diagnosed and treated for the ongoing, continuous, serious injuries, those injuries being the RSD reflex, sympathetic dystrophy, and the complex regional pain syndrome. In doing that, he had to review the records of many other doctors. And they keep saying he reviewed records that were given to him by defense counsel, and he gave him an expert opinion on that. You can read this record in vain to find any testimony that would support that accusation, because it's not true. He did review many, many records, but in the process of treating him, if you read it in there, every bit of the testimony of Dr. Schifini with respect to those issues is about his treatment and how he went about diagnosing RSD and CPRS.
When did he review those records? Was it before or after his medical records were produced?
It was a part of his medical records. It was produced, and it was a part of his treatment. There was nothing, there was no discovery dispute here, as has been insinuated, that he came to court and he had a bunch of records that they didn't know about. If whatever was requested was produced, his records were produced, he testified. If you go and look at it, you simply don't find what they're talking about. They make it sound like he came and testified to a bunch of documents. They ask him about what he reviewed, and he talked about what he reviewed. But carefully read that, and you will see he testified only to his own treatment. Now, there is the issue of the...
You haven't answered my question. What does the record show about when he reviewed records other than his own?
During the treatment. There's nothing in the record that shows that he reviewed those records as anything but a part of his treatment. There's no evidence that it was reviewed for those other reasons, and that's why it's different than that federal case, Giorgi. Because there, it was a completely different thing. The only thing that's the same between that is that defense counsel used the same doctor and used him in a different way. So that case doesn't inform this case.
What about the standard of care? I mean, the standard of certainty.
The standard of certainty. Dr. Franklin, or Mr. Franklin testified, basically had no basis whatsoever for his opinion. He didn't even go to the stadium, I mean to the casino, to view whether it would be safe there or not safe there. He just said it's only safe, and the other doctor, Cargill, he just simply testified to matters of the money, but not to any standard. It is true that it was brought up after the fact. It was a judge trial and a motion. The judge heard it. She felt like, not just because he didn't use the standard words, they didn't say anything that would meet that any standard. And the judge actually said, she, even though she thought that they should have used magic words, she said that the testimony was not helpful to her. She also said that even with the testimony, she would have ruled the same way, because she didn't find it credible. So even if she applied the wrong standard, it's certainly a harmless error.
And that would be in her order denying the motion for new trial?
That's in her order, yes.
Denying the motion for new trial?
That would be in the order striking the experts.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
there's a lot to cover in a minute and 55 seconds, but I'll do my best here. For one thing, Chief Justice Pickering, you asked whether liability was based upon the policy, the so-called POMS policy, and you read from part of the order, but later in that order, the judge clearly indicates at volume 17 of the appendix, page 3243, the defendant's policy and the breach thereof is the reason why she found liability as a matter of law. Now, you've also asked some questions about Dr. Safini's records and whether these thousands of pages of records were in Dr. Safini's files, and when did he review them? Mr. Wong has given you information which, quite frankly, is simply not correct. There is nothing in the record that I'm aware of indicating that Dr. Safini read those things as part of his treatment. In fact, the record is clear that what he provided to defense counsel was 21 pages of records. Then he showed up at trial, and for the first time, defense counsel found out that there were more. And Dr. Safini testified that he had reviewed thousands of records. They could have only come from plaintiff's counsel. And there's nothing in the record indicating that he reviewed those as part of his treatment. Now, to get back to the liability, Mr. Wall argues that, that these two employees who he says were the highest level employees, well, first of all, they were mid to low level employees, but they only expressed their own personal opinions. And they said that there was no POMS policy. It was just their own opinions. And they didn't even say that the conduct was dangerous, as Mr. Wall indicates here. What they said was that it was inappropriate. And plaintiff's counsel tried to get Sherry Wong to say that it was unreasonable, and she said, no, not unreasonable, inappropriate. So that was just the opinions of two employees, which is not a policy and cannot be binding, at least under the Rayburn case. Unless the court has any other questions.
I do not. I want to thank both counsel for their briefs and oral arguments, which were excellent. We'll stand in recess for 5 minutes while we bring Justice Perry.